This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the Spirit Square studio of WFAE in Charlotte. I'm Frank Stacio. Harvey Gantt says he didn't think much about racial segregation as a kid in the Jim Crow South. Neither did his friends and neighbors. It was, as he put it in one interview, accepted. But as his awareness about social order, power, and politics grew, the accepted became unacceptable. By the time Harvey Gantt reached high school, he was leading sit-in protests against racial discrimination. His actions sparked a citywide movement of sit-ins around Harvey Gantt's native Charleston, South Carolina. But by then, he was off to lead another fight to become the first African-American student admitted to Clemson University, and he won. After college, he became an architect, fell in love with his first wife, Cindy, and with his wife first, I should say, with his wife first, Cindy, and of course, then right here in Charlotte, North Carolina, his second love. In 1983, Harvey Gantt became the first African-American mayor of the Queen City, served two terms as a Democrat, entered the national stage during two unsuccessful efforts to defeat U.S. Senator Jesse Helms. They were nasty campaigns in which Helms, a Republican, resorted to bluntly racist ads to save his seat. Today, Harvey Gantt is retired from seeking office. He's a partner with Gantt Huberman Architects and interior designers here in Charlotte, but he's still a major player on the city's political scene. And he's graciously taken some of his time to join us on the program today to talk about his life as a civil rights activist, his political legacy, and his beloved city. Harvey Gantt, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Frank.
I didn't want to give you more than one wife. I put the first in the wrong place. Your first love. But let's start with this convention and the city and what this means to be holding this convention in this year in the city of Charlotte, North Carolina.
It is huge. It is big for us. We've always been a city made up of aspiring citizens and leaders who always wanted to reach for the brass ring, so to speak. And that's been the way it's been since I've been here and came here some well over 45 years ago. Charlotte has always tried to get away from simply being mixed up with being Charlottesville, Virginia, or Charleston, South Carolina. And even people in North Carolina didn't own us too much. We were Charlotte, South Carolina for a while. So we've had this identity complex for some time. But it's a city that the boosterism you see here goes beyond just simply trying to be something you're not. We actually think we are a great city. We think we've been working on becoming a great city for a long time. And we've had the good fortune of doing a number of things that benefited us and put us ahead of what we consider to be our competitor cities. We have the biggest airport now around in this region, sixth busiest in the world. We managed to get those professional sports teams here, basketball and football. We have had the Final Four. We've had the NBA All-Star Game. But the Democratic National Convention takes us to a different level. And to have had the chutzpah to simply say to the DNC, you need to come south again. You hadn't done it since 1988, and that was Atlanta. You need to come south to see the progress we are making here. You need to come south to see how we're dealing with public education, how we're dealing with situations like mass transit, how we're dealing with energy situations, how we're dealing with sustainability. We are a new American city. And most importantly, you need to come south because you shouldn't fear coming south again. Much of what Charlotte looks like is what the Democratic Party is all about, diversity. The fact that we have African American and women in all aspects of our public lives in terms of public policy making and government and industry and so forth and so on. So this is big. And we think it's big also because people will leave now knowing where Charlotte is and what Charlotte's about. When you got 15,000 media here from all over the world, I was with a group yesterday that was from Great Britain and other parts of Europe and Africa, and they're all focusing on us. There are some legacies. There are some benefits that we're going to get from this.
It's the city of Charlotte, certainly, and how it's changed. As you said, it's gotten a lot bigger. It's a city that can handle a convention like this in every way. that's required. What about the state of North Carolina? How have things changed here, and what makes this state an important state for something like the Democratic National Convention?
Well, North Carolina is part and parcel of what's happening in Charlotte, in my opinion. I think that our state, in a lot of ways, is continually remaking itself. The basic industries that caused us sustenance, economic sustenance over the years, have faded away, and now we're dealing with the high-tech culture, the research triangle, the kinds of things we see going on in the triad, and certainly what's happening here in Charlotte in banking and in energy, all suggest that the state is remaking itself. And it's attractive. It's the 10th largest state in the country, and it's bringing in new people and new blood and new energy and new creativity and new innovations. So North Carolina itself, I think, is becoming one of the premier states in this country. And we like to think that Charlotte's right there with it.
I want to find out a little bit more about you and go back a little bit into your biography. We said you grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, and that community was segregated, of course, a fact of life for people who were living there. Describe your childhood for us.
I did grow up in Charleston and grew up in the 40s and the 50s in that community. I had a wonderful family. Went to a school that was a neighborhood school that wasn't far away from mine. There's always some curiosities about my childhood because there was two of everything, two elementary schools in my neighborhood, one white, one black, two water fountains everywhere you went, two sets of restrooms wherever you went, two parts of the buses that you had to live to sit on, one white, one black. And as a child, I didn't pay much attention to that. There might have been some curious questions I might have wanted to ask about whether the water was different if you drank it from the white water fountain as opposed to the black one. But I was comfortable, and I thought I had a happy childhood and still believe that I did. But as I grew older, we learned more. And I think the seminal thing that changed for me was in 1954 at the age of 11 when the Supreme Court on May 17th of that year ruled that segregation was unconstitutional. And I can still see the headlines in the evening paper at that time that we used to get. And I recall my father, who always talked about current events in the community, was much more vocal with us children then, and I was the oldest in the family. But he talked now about what that meant, and he said, you know, your world's going to change. You're going to be able to reach for things you've never reached for before. This is going to be a life-changing experience for us and our family.
Did your father encourage you to become active? You said he talked about current
events. My father
was
a member of the NAACP. That was not something very popular that people did back then. But he had the courage to do so, and probably motivated by the fact that he probably felt cheated by not being able to get a high school diploma, because he grew up in the rural parts of Charleston County where there were no high schools for African Americans. So that he was determined that his kids were all going to be educated. And I think he's been blessed to see all five of his children get graduate degrees from college. He believed in that very strongly. Education was the key to the future. When I went to Clemson, ultimately, that was an ultimate kind of payback, so to speak, for the denial of his high school diploma because of segregation.
Well, before you got to Clemson, you went to high school, and there you led sit-ins, did you?
I did, along with some other students. I don't want to let my friends who did that recognize that there were three of us that organized our NAACP Youth Council when we were juniors in high school, and by the time we got to be seniors, we saw something happen in Greensboro, North Carolina, that we thought was pretty cool. And we said, you know, maybe we are tired of drinking Cokes and hot dogs standing up, not being able to sit down at a lunch counter. So as seniors in high school, 27 of us decided one day, without telling our parents or anybody else, we just marched down and sat in at a lunch counter. Trained ourselves to expect that civil disobedience was going to mean that you might get some jeers, you might even have some physical harm to come to you. But we thought that it was important enough that we do it, even if we were just 16 and 17 years old.
Well, tell us a little bit about that training, because certainly there was a lot of training that went on in Greensboro and Nashville to prepare for what you were going to receive. You say you trained yourself?
Well, a complicating thing about what we were doing is that we didn't tell anybody. We didn't tell any of the adults. A few teachers knew that we were doing something interesting. We read a lot. We didn't have the internet to go online to see exactly how to do it, but we'd gotten some information from people who were involved in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and SCLC and some other groups like that that talked about how you go about nonviolent civil disobedience, and that you needed to be prepared to endure the kind of suffering you were going to endure. Be silent, and you make your point. And we played games with each other amongst ourselves to sort of see how people could stand up to that. And, you know, it turned out okay.
Did your family say, your parents?
Well, when they came in, we were obviously arrested the day that we sat in. And my mother came in to the courtroom because that's where they kept us. They really didn't put us in jail because 16, 17-year-old, 18-year-old kids, they didn't want to put us in jail. We sat at that lunch counter for about 8 or 9 hours, and then we were hauled off to jail. And our parents came to get us after NAACP attorneys arranged for our release. And everybody's parent came in really angry, or at least they feigned anger. It was not until we were in the car headed home, you know, that my parents said, "You know what? I'm just really proud of you. You all had the guts to do that, and that's great."
You know, what you just said is very interesting. It never occurred to me, but what you'd have to do as black parents coming into that white courtroom is pretend that there was going to be hell to pay, however you might have felt about it.
That's exactly right.
And thought about that. But they said they were proud of you, and apparently it left an impression. You applied to Clemson University, which now wouldn't be that hard, but that was an all-white school.
I hadn't thought of applying to Clemson at the time that I sat in at the lunch counter. We met an attorney named Matthew Perry, who came and spoke to us, and he talked about all the possibilities, similar to what my father had been saying, that when segregation was outlawed, you'd be able to reach for things that he never could reach for. And Matthew Perry pointed out that Clemson, you know, had a great school of engineering, and some of you are going to one day go to school there. And we took that in, but we were more concerned at that point when he was there with us that as a civil rights attorney, we needed to know whether or not we were going to have a record one day for having sat down at a lunch counter with that and hinder us. And he said he didn't think so. First of all, you're going to win the case. And we ultimately did win in the Supreme Court. Trespassing charges were dropped. It was not until about 2 years later, in my beginning of my sophomore year, that I applied to Clemson. On the theory that I didn't like Iowa, it was too cold, I wanted to practice architecture in the South, I saw other Southern students, black students, going to places like the University of Georgia and Alabama, and an application was something that I thought I'd do.
When did you decide to become an architect? How long had that been?
Oh, I made that decision back in high school. No, I decided to do that about ninth grade.
Because it's interesting. You know you're going to have a fight if you go to a place like Clemson. You have a dream. You want to become an architect. That's something you're sure of. And then there's this fight on your hands if you decide to take it to Clemson.
Maybe I was naive, but, you know, South Carolina was the last state to integrate its schools. Every other state had done it, by 1962, when James Meredith went to the University of Mississippi. But I'd always thought that South Carolina might not even put up any resistance to it. I'd watched North Carolina integrate its school of law and other, and they did it quietly. Nobody raised a lot of sand about it. So when I made those first applications, the first response was, "Great, you want to come to Clemson? Send us your high school transcript, your current transcript." And I did that. And that's when they discovered that I was an African American by my high school transcript. Segregated schools, it was easy to determine that. And then four other applications, I kept applying, and they kept turning me down for various reasons. And then it became clear to me that this was going to be a fight.
How did you win that fight?
Well, we had to take it to court. We filed a lawsuit against the state of South Carolina and Clemson University that was tried in Greenville and Anderson, I'm sorry, and ultimately decided by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and upheld by the Supreme Court.
What was that first year like for you?
It was a good one. Not nearly as bad as people all thought, primarily because of the leadership at Clemson and primarily because students are students. I recall someone, some ardent segregationist saying, just before I entered Clemson, he said, now, all right, Harvey Gantz won the court suit. Now, if you students would just isolate him socially, ostracize him, he will be so uncomfortable working on a difficult course like architecture that he'll leave and we'll be back to our beloved all-white institution. And I laughed at that because he obviously hadn't been a student in a long time. I knew that 18, 22-year-olds were people, and they probably had some notions and thoughts about what was going to happen in their own Southland. And I made great friends. There are some people who didn't want me there, but for the most part, most people were indifferent or friendly to me. And I had a great first year and a great second year.
And you became an architect in a field at that time, and I think still today is notoriously white field. So what about afterward, making your way into this profession, becoming a success? Was that difficult?
You know, I had good grades at Clemson, very good grades, and tough teachers, great critics, and probably would never have come to North Carolina. But the job opportunity offered to me in Georgia and North Carolina were ones that allowed me to make a choice, and I chose Charlotte. South Carolina, interestingly enough, most of the architectural firms didn't deny my talent. They simply felt that it might be detrimental to them to have a notorious, if not famous, person.
So it was. You did come to Charlotte. And you started working here. When did you decide to get into politics?
Well, actually, I came here for 3 years to do my internship as an architect. And I went away to graduate school at MIT, came actually back to Charlotte, to Durham, to the Triangle area, and then moved back to Charlotte to form the firm with Jeff Huberman. And when Cindy and I moved back to Charlotte, I said, I'm going to use my planning degree, my master's degree in urban planning, to see if I could help shape the city of Charlotte by advising, by consulting with those who were making public policy in Charlotte. And I did do exactly that. I talked to quite a few council members and others about my opinions on various things that were going on. And actually, our firm got to design some neighborhood centers in Charlotte and got a chance to appear before city council. And the next thing I knew, Fred Alexander decided to run for the North Carolina Senate, and he won a race and had an empty seat for about a year. And rather than get involved with the political type folks who wanted that seat, they decided to ask a guy who was more of a professional planner if he would at least take Fred's seat for a year. And I took that seat and took to politics like a duck takes to water, I suppose.
It's a different kind of world, though. It's a rough and tumble world. It's not planning and advising and consulting on the best idea. It's winning, right?
It's also convincing people and bringing folks together. That's what I loved about it. And I really equated it a lot to architecture. In architecture, we assemble ideas from people, take thousands of different pieces of building material and recreate this wonderful symphony called a building. And in politics, you do the same thing. You have conservative views, liberal views, and the leader tries to figure a way to satisfy everybody and move the needle. And I thought there was a lot of similarities between what I was doing for public service and what I was doing every day to earn a living.
We will talk about how Harvey Gantt did that in Charlotte as we continue our program here. We're live from Charlotte, host city of the 2012 Democratic National Convention. My guest, architect and former mayor of Charlotte, Harvey Gantt. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things from Spirit Square Studio of WFAE in Charlotte. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour is architect and former Charlotte mayor, Harvey Gantt. When did you then decide? So it's one thing to take a seat, and you're the consensus candidate to fill out that term. But then you decide to run for mayor, and you would become the city's first black mayor. This has got to be a difficult decision, or was it, to take on a challenge like that?
As I said earlier, I actually took to politics like a duck takes to water, and I didn't realize that. I didn't aspire to running for a public office. But I actually enjoyed going out and talking to people. I actually enjoyed the campaign. I actually enjoyed the exchange of ideas. I really did. I loved the debates, and those were city council elections in which I ran at large, even after working with others to bring about districts in Charlotte. I loved the idea of running across the entire city. And Charlotte was at a crossroads in its planning in the late 70s. It was growing so fast, but it was essentially growing in one direction. And so my planning background said, you know, there's a different set of policies we ought to be talking about. And I decided I'd run for mayor when the current mayor decided he was not going to run for a second term. The guy's name was Ken Harris. He was a Republican, and he decided not to run and left an open seat. And I ran against Eddie Knox, who was then a state senator, in the Democratic primary. I made the decision to run because I said, you know what? I think I can help on this issue of growth. And I think that's the key issue, just as we talk about the economy being the big issue today. Back then, it was how Charlotte was going to grow. And so I got in the race with him, and we had a heck of a primary, one of the best races I've ever run in my life, and I lost by a few hundred votes, but I lost the primary. And Eddie went on to become the mayor, and we became friends. I ran again for city council in 1981. And then Eddie Knox, as you'll recall, decided to run for governor in 1984. But in 1983, I ran for mayor and won that race.
What, when you say the city was headed in one direction when it came to growth, what direction was that you thought was wrong?
Well, first of all, we were piling too much into one section of Charlotte, the southeast part of the community. And I thought there'd be diminishing returns if we continued to widen roads and to increase the congestion down there and the pollution and all the other kinds of stuff associated with the runaway subdivisions and developments that developers were putting forward. And thought that we should take advantage of the federal grants we'd gotten for building sewage treatment plants in other parts of Charlotte, and to extend that by taking municipal dollars and billing the umbilical cords of growth in other parts of the community. And so the area up around the University of North Carolina at Charlotte was largely farmland and the university. We thought that needed to be developed. In Northwest Charlotte, the black community needed more than simply landfills and other kinds of things, more libraries, more other resources to make those communities better. And that was the platform I ran on.
You painted earlier a virtuous and, I think, admirable picture of politics. You talked about it being like a building, a symphony of materials that come together, and the role of the politician is to facilitate that conversation, to hear from all sides. The cynic will say that when you have a conversation like that about a city, it's not about ideas. It's not about the best plan. It's about where the money is. And if the money says we're moving it here, there's no argument or conversation that could be had that can persuade those interests.
Well,
how does it work? How do you sort of get past that?
Well, there's no question that budgets set priorities, and budgets is all about where the money is going to be allocated.
Well, forgive me, and it's not just the money that the city can bring, but the money that developers and others
Absolutely.
Can bring and what they want and
Absolutely.
Where they want.
But I also understood that a lot of what the developers needed, the public sector had to provide initially. And that's a basic understanding that the people themselves, their tax dollars enable some things to happen. There's an interesting debate going on currently about did you build that or did you not build it? What role does the government play? In this case, the government plays a substantial role in how cities grow and the directions they grow in. Developers do what we want them to do, which is to invest dollars, but they invest dollars in large measure as a result of the direction. Now, many of those people set the direction if they become good at politics and influence politicians to go in a certain direction. I should share with you that I did not get the support of developers in my campaigns for mayor. because, in fact, I was asking them to do some things that were not natural for them to want to do, which is if we're milking a cow in a certain direction, we need to keep milking it until it's dry. Right. And I'm simply said, let's find some new directions to
go. That means that you had to persuade other people who had a stake, who don't have that kind of power, influence, or money, but who can vote, to somehow let their voice be heard and persuade others on the
council
to move things.
That's the beauty of it, though.
I'm wondering now, as you look at the landscape today with fewer and fewer people engaged, with the private sector taking over so much control and so much of the public sector out of the picture now, as we privatize more and more, if that's true, and you can challenge that if you don't like what I said, I accept that, does it mean that there's a smaller role for, you know, people who have less influence in politics if public policy isn't driven in part by public infrastructure, public spending? In other words, if I take public spending out, I take the public out of the picture, and then the people with the money have their way. That's the simplified version of that.
And that's why I'm a little bit leery of some of the conservative philosophy that says, let's make government smaller and smaller and smaller. Well, something's got to replace that. So does that mean that the private sector is capable of doing all these other things? I'm not a great big lover of privatizing everything out there. And we haven't seen as much of that here in Charlotte, perhaps not even in North Carolina yet. It may be coming. It may be coming. But I think a job – one of the jobs of a good public policymaker is to get people to appreciate the role that the public sector does play. Because it's the role that people are playing. It's the role that your tax dollars are playing. So that when people mess that up, it doesn't help. When people are using our dollars carelessly, it does not help build the case. But when you can show that investment does it, when we could show back in the day that the investment in a 10,000-foot runway paid for by public dollars or the investment of water and sewer lines in the northeast and the northwest sections of Charlotte increased the tax base and made it better for everyone. When you make those kinds of cases to the citizenry, you have an opportunity to build a strong community. Now, I told you, I actually enjoyed the debate that went on back in the 70s and the 80s, and for that matter, and even into the 90s, into the present. I enjoy the notion that you've got an idea and I've got a competing idea, and let's test that in the public arena. Let's let people look at what we're saying. And what I don't see often enough is a willingness. I see too many ideologues who are stuck on one side and not willing to hear any other viewpoint. And not enough people who are knitters of public policy, who try to bring a good point from one side. There is a role for privatization, in my opinion, but there's a huge role that the government still has to play. And I think the Republicans do us a disservice by simply saying there is that the government, as small as we can get it, is really where we want to go, because somehow they make it sound as if that's a bad thing. I mean, it's gotten to the point now where people, when you say public sector, or when you say government, that's a bad thing. And then you ask them why, and sometimes they can't explain why. Yeah. Yet they drive down streets and use traffic signals and have their garbage picked up, and, you know, it's a bad thing.
I want to talk about your two races against Jesse Helms. You're running against Jesse Helms. Now you're going to run for the U.S. Senate. You've already served as mayor of Charlotte. Jesse Helms, did you know what you were up against? Did you have – those were some nationally renowned, now notorious campaigns, dirty campaigns, racist campaigns. Did you know what you were up against going into that race?
Yes, I think I was very much aware that those were going to be tough campaigns. But the reason we got into the first one was our good friend Jim Hunt decided not to run a second time after he lost the 1984 race. And Mel Watt and I, playing tennis in our backyard, said, isn't it a shame that we are not going to have a strong representative like a Jim Hunt to hold up the Democratic cause in the 1990 campaign? And isn't 1990 an important year, even though we're not going to be electing a president, that this race could, in fact, say a lot about where America might be going? And shouldn't we talk about those principles of education and the environment and health care in 1990? Don't we need to have someone who can be strong in articulating those views? We said, yes, who? And then we decided, hey, nobody else will, we will. Even though we don't have any money, we're going to go do this. And notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Helms might be a tough person to go up against, who held on to views that we shall call more traditional to North Carolina's past, we thought it was worth going up against him. That, in fact, the color of my skin might be a retardant to his ability to be as biased as he might had been in the past with some candidates. And so we got in the race.
It wasn't. It didn't slow him down at all. In fact, he resorted to racist advertising throughout the campaign. And many analysts say it's what won the race for him. You emphasized that
but
it was in the past.
But Frank, you should be aware of the fact that if you follow the track of that campaign, for a good period there, he ran a clean campaign as far as we were concerned. As a matter of fact, the reason for the famous hands ad was because we thought we had done an excellent job of inoculating his supporters who actually felt we might win it. And that they were not going to vote for Harvey Gantt, but they were just disappointed in Jesse's Rose Garden campaign.
Was the Democratic establishment with you when you said you wanted to run for this? How
no,
much support did you get?
Of course not. I mean, after all, here I was, a North Carolinian who went to Clemson, who was from Charlotte. Who was also African American. It just didn't seem like one of those races that the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee or the Democrats themselves in general would want to put their dollars in. And we understood that. We understood that we had to convince them that we had a chance of winning, that North Carolina was changing, that it was unlike a lot of Southern states, Democrats and Republicans had a real shot at winning. And Jesse Helms' races were always going to be decided by 4 to 6 percentage points.
What did you learn from those campaigns, and what do you take away from those races?
I always believed that even though I lost both of them, that North Carolina was headed in the direction of the kind of vision I had for the state, much more progressive, education being high on the agenda. It would become the state I see it becoming today. I didn't see the politics going quite the way it's gone in the North Carolina General Assembly, but clearly, the views I held with regard to education and health care and other kinds of things were more of where the state was going than Jesse's views of the world. One might argue after the Republican convention last week that maybe Jesse's winning, but I'm not sure about that. I'm certain that he isn't winning. And we might have an aberration here and there, but I actually felt very good as you can feel, not winning the seat after trying twice, to simply say the people who will run for the Senate seat in North Carolina in the future are going to hold more of my views than those who are going to. Now, Richard Burr might not be quite that view, but we've had John Edwards and we've got Kay Hagan, and I think that people like that are going to continue to do well.
And Mayor Anthony Fox, the current mayor of Charlotte, who worked on your campaigns, is in a sense a protege of yours, considers you a mentor. Does he have a future in this party, in national politics, do you think?
I think he has a great future. I think he has a great future. And I think that, as my father said to me, you can reach for a lot of opportunities, and I think he can. He's in an environment where people have grown accustomed to having an African-American president. They've certainly seen the African-American governors. He can probably go that direction, or he can reach for the Senate.
There's a great picture making the rounds these days, Barack Obama wearing a Harvey Gantt for Senate T-shirt. looking young. And so things have moved. Things have come along.
Things have changed.
What about the party itself? Here's a party that in 2008 should have knocked out the Republican Party by all accounts, given what had happened in the years prior to that. There were those who were saying the Republican Party would be a long way from ever winning another race. 2 years later, they're back in power. Where is the Democratic Party? Does it have a future, and what is that future?
The Democratic Party definitely has a future in North Carolina, as does the Republican Party. I think that we are always going to be a state where the differences are going to be very close. And in a way, I'm proud of the state. When you look at other southern states that are totally red, totally Republican, we've got a state in which I'm sort of delighted that we're going to be a battleground state for a while. I'd like us to stay bluish or blue as many times as we can, but I think there's something to be said about a state where the country pays attention to what we do here. And if we run good people for public office, as I think we've got a good slate this year, we can win elections, even in election years that Barack Obama doesn't run. I think in 2010, we got a little lazy. In 2010, we were losing some of our old leadership. In 2010, we had some scandals that were occurring. None of that helped our party. And I think there were others on the other side who were organizing and putting dollars into Republican races. And we were asleep at the switch, I think.
Harvey Gantt, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt, a partner with Gantt Huberman Architects and Interior Designs here in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. You can find out more at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.